very much. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure that no words of mine could express to you how deeply grateful I am for the things that have taken place here so far today, for the presentations representing so many of you in your own union organizations, even the presentation I put in my pocket, which will help. You know, Napoleon said there were three things that were necessary in fighting a war, and I think they also fit politics. He said the first was money, and he said the second was money, and the third was money. But also for the people who have spoken here today, for these people from my own industry, from Buddy, George, Colleen, the people who've come up here, you know it's sweet to be approved by your fellow man, but it's doubly so when it comes from those you hold in esteem and affection. And I am grateful. I know that these people are here in spite of one deep failure that probably lingers and lurks in their minds. None of them have ever been invited to join the Rat Pack. But this is a wonderful occasion. You know, with the remarks that were made here, and I'm sure they must have moved you and shocked you, as they did all of us, to learn some of the things that go on when perhaps government sets its hand without enough control of things that are not legitimately government's concern. But I've often thought, in that so-called war on poverty, and poverty's losing, I've often thought about that election they held recently. And you remember the one where such a tiny fraction of the people showed up to vote with regard to representation in the handling of the affairs, and everyone took a hand at explaining why they thought this had happened, this tiny turnout of voters. And you know, I've got my own theory, and I don't mind saying it. When I look back now on my boyhood, I have to realize, with the advantage of hindsight, that we were poor. But you know, at the time, we didn't know it. And I have a hunch that this is just what happened. There were an awful lot of people that didn't know that they were supposed to be in that war on poverty. They're working, they're sending their kids to school, they're paying their bills, they're going to church and contributing to their community, their charitable efforts in their community. And as I say, they just haven't found out yet that they're supposed to be dependent on the rest of us. And Colleen, do you mind if I just straighten something else out here, too, that doesn't need straightening, really? I'm sure they all understand. No. But I just think that, just in case, because I've been getting kind of used lately to people on my side being misquoted. Nope, you didn't. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. Lest someone place a technical interpretation on Colleen's references to religion and our own participation in it, I don't think this is necessary here. But since the governor has seen fit recently to have someone tape everything I say, and one of these microphones is his, make no mistake about it, I know Colleen very well. And Colleen was not meaning to infer that there should be any narrow technical interpretation of the terms she used. She was speaking of all of those people in our Judeo-Christian tradition who are people concerned and believing that God is not dead. We just can't talk to him in the school. Don't you worry, Colleen. You didn't say it wrong. As I say, I'm just getting used to this. You know, the governor does. He has a fellow taping everything I say. And this is why one day there was such a great fuss made about that I didn't know where the Eel River was. When I know where the Eel River is. That's the governor. I'm glad it missed. Just a lamp that fell and missed. But you see, it isn't the fact that the governor tapes what I say. It's the fact that the scissors go to work, and then they edit, and it comes out sounding a little different. Let me give you an illustration of how they can make it come out sounding different. And they put it in their campaign literature. And this accounts for many of the things that, for example, you're reading in some of your labor papers as they come to you, that are coming down from the hierarchy of labor. A statement, for example, that I said in a society that is based on individual freedom, it is a strange paradox that parents are forced to send their children to school. Now, I said that. Every word of it makes me sound pretty anti-intellectual, doesn't it? But let's see what it sounded like before the scissors got in there. I said that, and then I added, it is a paradox that we gladly put up with because we know we can't have a free society unless we have an educated and literate citizenry. Comes out different, doesn't it, when you finish it? So I've just taken care of the editing here. Do you know when I mentioned the Eel River? Let me again tell you something that can happen. The other day, I was up north, and I knew that I was being put on. I knew that this fellow wasn't there just in the legitimate area of questioning when he said, what about the Marysville Reservoir? Well, now, the water program has got just literally hundreds of proposed dams and reservoirs. And I doubt if anyone, including the director of the program, could offhand tell you every problem concerning the location of every one of these. Because the water program is that thick. And I've been hearing a great deal lately about the governor's water program and the governor's dams and the governor's reservoirs and the governor's canals. It almost makes you think when he leaves office, he's going to take his water with him. But you know, normally, if this was a legitimate question, the fellow would have said to me, we have a problem in this area concerning. What is your view? And tell me what the problem was. So I fished around. I shouldn't have, and I guessed at a couple of things that I'd heard about generally some problems that have to do with controversy between the sportsmen who think the dams are going to interfere with the sport fishing and this sort of thing. And each time he just shook his head. Well, I knew what he was doing to me, and I knew that I was going to hear about this just like I'd heard about the Eel River. And sure enough, the very next night, the governor was speaking in Marysville. And the governor said proudly, I know where the Marysville Dam is going to be. Do you know what he didn't tell them? He didn't tell them that the next morning after that questioning, the morning before he was to make that speech, the governor's office called the water program and said, please, quick, tell us, where is the Marysville Dam going to be? Well, you know, I'm getting used to the editing. And now that doesn't bother me so much. But I'll tell you what has been bothering me. All my life, I've prepared my own speeches and determined everything I'm going to say. And lately, I've had an uneasy feeling that I'm writing the governor's speeches, too. Lately, the governor has been moving so far toward that moderate center of the road that some of his own factions over there, a little left of center, are beginning to question whether he isn't betraying them. He's going to do something about the rehabilitation of welfare, and he's going to do something about the cost of government. He made a speech on August 13th to his own party's convention, and in that speech, and I have it on my desk by actual count, there are 79 promises in one speech. Now, these aren't bad promises. Pretty good. They're all things that he hasn't done for 8 years, things that could have been done. Now we're to believe he can do them. And that's why I make one promise right here. I'm going to seek whatever legislation is necessary to see that henceforth governors of California serve no more than 2 terms. Now, you know, that's one. The one beautiful thing about this promise is we don't have to wait till we get the legislation. We can start November 8th, keeping that promise. But in spite of all his promises or all his speeches, I don't really believe they reflect a change of philosophy. Tracing back, you can find that his has been a promising career. On September 2nd, here in Los Angeles, he made a promise that had to do with the control of narcotics. And that was a good promise. And it was a good promise when he made it January 29th, 1953, when he was Attorney General. And a good promise when he made it again in 1958, running for governor. And a good promise when he made it in 1962. Yes, it is a good promise all the way. And yet in these last 8 years, as the crime rate has been rising in California, let me make one correction there. I did goof, and they caught me with the tape. I said that the crime rate, which has been skyrocketing in California to where we have double our share, that it began with his term as governor. And boy, they were on the wire the next morning to correct that one. Showed just how little I knew. It didn't begin when he began as governor. It began when he was attorney general and could have done something about it. But now he went up through the valley. Incidentally, he's accused me of employing some head shrinkers to pick your brains. And he says that on this basis, I find out what frightens the people, and then I make all my speeches aimed at frightening the people into supporting me. Well, I hate to give away a secret that I've nursed for a little while here, but it's easier than that to find out what the issues are. The issues are all those things the governor doesn't want to talk about. Those are the issues. And he went up through the valley the other day, and he made something of an admission himself. And I'm a little shocked by it. He said, for public dissemination, that he didn't believe he could run successfully for re-election on his record. Well, I can understand that. You can't make something out of nothing. So he said that he was going to run by attacking me. Now, I didn't really think that that was anything new. For a time there, it looked as if I was the issue of this campaign. But really, the issues that he doesn't want to talk about are issues that cross party lines. And they're issues that involve organized labor and all the working men and women of our state. They're the issues of the cost of government. A cost of government that has gone up to the point where if you're the average family of four, your share of the cost of state government for your family is $952.44. And that's up $400 in just these 8 years. Now, the governor has been saying in his campaign that for seven consecutive years, there's been no budget deficit and that there's been no increase in taxes. Who is he kidding? Anyone here want to tell us that his taxes haven't gone up in the last 7 years? Property taxes, double what they were, and increasing twice as fast as the increase in personal income. And there isn't a working man or woman today who doesn't know that because this tax keeps pace with inflation, that when we come to that retirement on Social Security or our pension, that fixed income that isn't going to go up with inflation, we won't be able to live out our lives in our own homes. We'll have to get rid of them and leave that basic security that at one time it was just an immutable economic law that your own home was the basis of your estate, was the fundamental of your security. This tax, property tax in California, is double the national average. Now, how does this come about? Well, it comes about when they dream up goodies at the state level for education. And more the state has been gathering over control from the local school districts of our public school system. They tell us that the AB 145 is designed by unification to reduce the 1,500 school districts to 300. But I don't think any of us would be surprised if somewhat what they really meant was that the 300 would become 58 county districts and eventually a single state system of education. But as they impose these programs on the local school boards, they don't furnish the money to make them work. And so the state has dropped from paying 50% of the share of education to 35% of the share. And at the local and the county level, there's only one place they can turn. Put it on the property tax. And when they dream up those goodies for welfare, and the county has to meet it with some matching funds, put it on the property tax, and away they go. I've mentioned welfare. This is an issue. It's an issue not because you and I have any intention of retreating from our tradition, our heritage of generosity, not because you and I want to do any less than our ultimate and our utmost for those people who are truly of need, those people who, through disability, age, or whatever, cannot provide for themselves. But there's another part of welfare that came into being with the most humanitarian of goals and purposes. Some three decades ago, in the depths of the Depression, when millions of good, responsible working people, through no fault of their own, in an economic crisis, found themselves willing to work but unable to work. And so we set out to have programs that were to temporarily tide us over in that area of welfare. But someplace we've gotten off the track. Someplace. Instead of having a program that was eventually supposed to eliminate itself, a program that was supposed to put people back out into productive jobs in a productive economy where there would no longer be a need for this kind of program, we today have perpetuated poverty. We've destroyed the very moral fiber and the soul of people as we find Californians who are the third and fourth generation of their families living on public subsistence. And they grow up and marry and have children expecting to continue that as a way of life. And the governor says, and some of our labor leaders have said of me that there's something inhumane in my suggesting that we should reform that program. You bet we should reform it. The governor... Now, not all of these people want to linger there. Some do. There are some who would like to be able to get out into the productive economy. Here in California, we've got 400,000 people unemployed. The governor boasts that we're in an unprecedented prosperity. Unemployment has dropped to a six-year low, but it's 28% higher than the national average. And now we've got 40,000 jobs calling for certain skills that are going begging because we don't have the people to go to work in those jobs. Well, the governor sent a man back to testify before the House Ways and Means Committee not too long ago to testify in favor of the federal government taking over the unemployment insurance program. And he suggests this is an improvement. Well, I suggest to you that the governor, by his own admission, has more and more, as he got deeper and deeper in trouble, been basing the economy of California on his attempt to get more and more in federal spending, to spend more and more from the public purse instead of doing something to refurbish the business climate to where we'll have the kind of prosperity that has jobs going begging, that has the employer seeking workers. And this is how salaries go up legitimately in the good law of supply and demand, how unions can go in and legitimately bargain for increased salary and increased and improved working conditions when you have that kind of a labor market. But no, the governor had his representative reading his statement back there. And literally he was admitting unemployment insurance in California is getting into trouble. Getting into trouble because in Sacramento, they no longer consider it the legitimate insurance that you and I believe it to be. The legitimate protection for the legitimate worker. No, they say it should be considered as a part of welfare. And they have loosened the means whereby a man can get on or a woman get on this program for benefits, to the place that you and I who are working are going to find someday when we must call upon it, that it has been weakened. And the governor knew when he testified in favor of federalizing this program that ours has been the best with regard to benefits. He knows that if this is put on a nationwide basis under federal control, you and I in California and the employers in California will be paying for people in other states, and they'll have to level down what they can do in this program, and we won't have all that we have here today. I don't think that the federal government is the answer to all our problems. Here in California, we build a pretty good society. But let me just get back to this issue of welfare and very briefly touch upon the kind of reform that we can have. Because I think somebody put a chalk mark on our door. As a matter of fact, this is plain in the governor's testimony before that committee, too. Plain that there are people coming to California, not coming here for opportunity, not to take those 40,000 jobs that are going begging. People that are coming here because there's a chalk mark on our door. They don't want to work, and they'd rather not work here than not work someplace else. And I don't think California workers should have to pay the freight for that kind of tourism. But what we could have is a reform that used the legitimate programs for job retraining, that used our welfare and our state labor department, and then used them in cooperation with our private industry in California. And I've already talked to some of the industrialists about this, and they're willing and they know it can be done. a program in which we'll organize welfare to funnel those people from welfare who are able-bodied and who can take training to go through job training programs and into jobs in private industry. And then they will go off the welfare rolls. And this can work because it's working right now in the Watts area of Los Angeles. They put almost 12,000 people to work, and it started with one man who had an idea, Chad McClellan, who got the industrialists in the room. Got him in a room and said, jobs are the responsibility of the private sector. This is the way we'll work this out. Now, I believe it can be spread to a state level. And I've already, as I say, been discussing this with people who are qualified to know, with industrialists. It worked in one place. It can work generally. And then we can have welfare investing instead of welfare spending. Investing in human beings to salvage them. This same kind of cooperation could lead to a state central agency that we don't have now, where private industry could make known the skills that are wanting all over the state, the jobs that are open, and then a man with a skill who is temporarily unemployed or laid off could call a central agency and find out where in the state is there a need for his kind of talent, his kind of ability and work, and no reason why we shouldn't have that. Now let me just, before I close, let me get down to the very subject of labor itself. You are proving here today, and you've made me so proud, you're proving what I have always said, that too many people today, with what could almost be suspected of an anti-labor bias, too many people, when they talk labor, they don't differentiate as they should. They don't differentiate between the upper crust, the hierarchy at a top level of labor, and the rank and file of workers in the labor unions, because I'm here to state I always differentiate. I know from experience that the rank and file labor union members in our country are just as fair-minded and patriotic and dedicated citizens as anyone else. Now, I was prepared for the governor's kind of campaign. I've seen him campaign before. But I really, I must confess, was not prepared for men that I know personally, for men in the upper ranks of labor management, in that professional hierarchy, men who have sat in my home, who have discussed the problems that George touched upon here in his remarks, back when we were trying to save this industry from communist domination. I wasn't prepared for these men to furnish to the labor papers throughout the country, to come out with labor documents and pamphlets in this campaign that cannot be called inaccuracies or distortions, that are lies. And the people who are publishing them in their papers know they are lies with regard to my position about labor. When I read The Propeller, the paper of the largest aerospace local, and it describes the 1947 strike when Herb Sorrell and those outlaw unions with an outlaw strike condemned by the AFL, when they attempted to do the bidding of the communists and close down the motion picture industry and gain economic control of that industry, when more than 30 legitimate unions were going through the massed pickets outside those studios, when homes were being bombed and cars tipped over and people maimed and injured. And you bet I'm proud of the people in our guild. We happen to be in a position that we could keep the industry open for those other workers who were going in simply because they had to have someone in front of the cameras. And I'm proud that a lot of little gals who could be out of business if somebody just messed up their face a little bit, they came through riding in police-escorted buses, kneeling on the floor to escape the rocks coming through the windows. And we kept the studios open and we licked that rump organization, that outlaw organization, the Conference of Studio Unions. But while we were doing that, I'm going to tell you something. I've only told this once before. I remember one night in those dark days when Herb Sorrell was calling those meetings almost daily or nightly in the old Hollywood Legion Stadium. I remember when a guest was introduced and he stood up proudly and announced himself as a friend and raised his hands above his head in the prize fighter's salute and greeted the assembled strikers there. That man was the district attorney of San Francisco, Edmund G. Brown. Now, we fought them, and I think we won. But when I read in this local paper today, no mention of the other unions, but it says that Ronald Reagan was a strike breaker, a scab who led his union through legitimate picket lines against legitimate unions who were out in the streets in a legitimate labor dispute. This is a lie. And the people who printed it know it's a lie, as it's a lie to indicate that as has been done by Mr. Bassett in a statement, a news release that's just been issued. Bassett knows better than this when he says that I'm so beholden to the people around me that if I become governor almost immediately, we're going to lose the right to have a union shop because I'll bring about right to work. Well, the Guild records happen to show that in 1958, I seconded the motion in the Guild board that put our union into that fight, not only waiting until it was a referendum issue, but we went into the fight trying to get people and persuade people not to sign the petition so they couldn't get it on the ballot. I am still opposed to right to work. But what the records also don't show... what the records don't show, and what Mr. Bassett should know if he thinks that I would make a deal or could be influenced by anyone around me, in 1958 when we took that action, and I was one of the five-man committee that was appointed by our guild, I was also employed on the General Electric Theater in one of the finest jobs in television. And I knew at that time that General Electric was going actively to get into the fight in California on the other side, endorsing and supporting right to work with finance and publicity and work. If I was ever going to make a deal, I think that would have been the time to make a deal. But I had an obligation to the Guild, and I served in the campaign against it. And I must say on General Electric's behalf, no one in General Electric suggested that I should be fired or that I was doing anything contrary. They said, you got a right to do what you want to do, and we got a right to do what we want to do, and that's the way it went. Now, I'm still opposed, but because I believe in a certain compulsion in a member or a person being required to join a union in order to do the work that he has chosen to do, I at the same time believe the government has a responsibility to protect that member, his democratic rights within that union, and that's why I shall seek legislation of the kind to guarantee in every union what we have in our own, that every union member will have the right in his union on all policy matters to a secret ballot. Governor's lack of leadership has also been evidenced in another area, kind of a no-man's land here in our state. You know, ever since the labor legislation went in at the national level, there has been a no-man's land in which the states could not handle the cases, and there were cases that could not be taken at the federal level, that the federal government would not take them. In 1959, under President Eisenhower and at his urging, and this was upheld since by the Supreme Court, it was determined for the first time that the states could assume jurisdiction in that no man's land. Now, here in our state, we have a kind of conciliation service. We have a labor policy. But never has this governor established the machinery to implement this labor policy. And I think it is time that that machinery be implemented. And to that end, I would suggest something that's never before been tried in this kind of labor management relations. This would be a Labor Management Resources Act. And it would have a Labor Management Resources Commission, or board. And it would be a tripartite, a three-man commission. The governor would appoint one man from labor and one man from management. And certainly he would appoint them on the proposals of the people in both labor and management so that it reflected their belief in who should represent them. And I know this is going to catch some of those fellows by surprise who are saying some of those other things about me, I believe that those two, labor and management, should pick a panel of seven that are mutually satisfactory, and the governor would then choose the third member of that panel from those seven that are satisfactory to the other two. And then we could implement labor management to protect both from unfair labor charges either way. We could implement a kind of a little Wagner Act here in California as amended by the Taft-Hartley Act, and again we could have a place that would guarantee that government would not sit at the table in collective bargaining, except the government would stand by as a referee to make sure that there were fair rules to govern such bargaining. My statement is very simple. I believe in collective bargaining. I believe in organized labor. I believe in the right of the union member to democracy within his own union. And I believe that if we had a secret ballot, some of the things that have been discussed here today could not happen. I don't believe that by majority rule, in a system such as ours, the minority outvoted in a union should be forced to contribute materially or their support or their endorsement of candidates who are not of their choosing. Now, but at the recent AFL-CIO state convention, one of the leaders at that convention said that they were going to follow a course, as we know, the course of endorsing someone else. And they said, we're going to use the AFL-CIO news, and we're going to use the labor papers, and we're going to brainwash the membership, and we're going to, quote, pound it through their thick heads. Well, I don't believe the union members have thick heads, and I don't believe they need brainwashing. And I don't believe, as Mr. Pitt said, I don't believe in his remark made a few years ago in an election, that a labor union member who did not follow the recommendations as to political campaigning of the labor leaders was guilty of an unfair labor act. This is a strange understanding of the American system. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this about winds up everything that I've wanted to say for a long time to a lot of people that I knew feel as you feel. I have faith and confidence in you. And I want to just say this one thing. You've made it very clear where you stand, and I am truly grateful. But lest there be any misunderstanding, don't send me to Sacramento. Don't vote for me if you think that I've got any intention of going up there and running this state all by myself. No one can. You just vote for me if you believe in yourself. If you believe, as I do, that the citizenry of California, from top to bottom, the rank and file citizenry, have the capability to manage their own destiny and run their own affairs, and I envision a state administration that will turn to the people of California to ask their thinking, their advice, their solution to the problems. And no longer will the average local union have to go through some self-anointed individual in the upper hierarchy who holds his position by way of saying that he has the governor's ear. I will assure you right now that on this governor's staff, there will be a man of labor, and the door will be open for the rank and file of labor and for the local union to come in and say what it is that they believe is wrong and needs correcting in the state of California. Thank you very much.